says interview with Gene Aitchison, side one. Gene, tell me something about yourself and your getting involved in this field, because you've become, you know, one of the international experts in thesaurus construction building, had a long association with CIG. But how did it all start?
Well, I was running a large library for the English Electric Company, now taken over by the GC. And I thought that it would be quite a good idea if we had a better classification system than we had. And as I was in CRG, I got all the ideas about the classification, and I thought here was an opportunity to try and develop something for my own company.
Had you been in CIG from the beginning?
No, I don't think quite from the beginning, but certainly from 1955.
Yes.
I don't know when the beginning of CIG was.
Pretty good before that.
Yeah. So that's how I got involved.
So that was the beginning. So let's look at the CIG just for a minute in those early days. The influence of Ranganathan, the faceted classifications, chain indexing, things of that sort.
Well, it was the people who had been in India and had been influenced by Ranganathan who were in the CIG, and that's how the faceted influence came on. It was Mr. Wells, who was the editor of the BNB, and sure about Eric Coates, probably Douglas Foskett.
I think Bernard Palmer too was.
Bernard Palmer.
It was, I think, the contact with Ranganathan.
Was it Bernard Palmer? Bernard Palmer.
I think so.
That's right, and Mr. Wells. Right.
Had you met Ranganathan?
Yes, I did meet Ranganathan. When I decided I was going to make the classification system for the English Electric Company Library at Rexton near Leicester, I arranged to meet him in London, and I did have a conversation with him, I think, before I met him at the Dorking conference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what was he like? I mean, what happened at this meeting with him? Because if you arranged a meeting, that's something in mind.
Well, yes, I think I wanted to ask him how it would be suitable for engineering, an engineering library. As I said, it's a long time ago, and all I can remember is the small, fairly bent figure wearing black, I believe. But honestly, I don't remember much more. It's quite a long time ago.
Of course.
Yeah. But he was at the Dorking Conference, and I don't think I spoke to him personally there. Okay.
So let's keep on going then. So you're now developing the classification system for the English Electric Company.
Yeah.
Was that and that is that that becomes the thesaurus asset?
Well, not immediately, because it's 1960, I think, that we had. 1, 2, even 3 editions of the what was called the English Electric Faceted Classification for Engineering, and then
that was you had developed that.
I developed that, and we had it published, and we had first of all we just part of the library what was the articles in the information bulletin. They were put into the new system to see how it worked. Worked reasonably well, and then we did the whole. We had a complete reclassification of the whole stock. Everybody in the library helping.
So this was turning out UDC in effect.
We turned out UDC, and but our trouble was that we did have a chain index with it, and this meant that the order that we had decided was that the machine were the most important thing, the parts next, then the operations, and then the theory in that order. And that meant that there were a lot of distributed facets. And sometimes, like my fatigue, which was what our engineers are really interested in, was scattered completely in the index. And that was one of the drawbacks. You know. And later on, I think in about 1962, a Cranfield research team came along and tested it. And I think they also found that this scatter of really important concepts of the engineers was a drawback. Mm-hmm. So in fact it worked reasonably well otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably why I say that I'm not sure whether it did work better than UDC in the end or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly was more focused towards the subject field that we were interested in. And another problem with that classification was that we decided, or I decided, because that was how CRG was thinking at the time, to divide the whole field into facets so that there was all engines and all parts, and together the whole division was by facet and really not by discipline, so that when disciplinary subjects were sought they were scattered, and that was another disadvantage of it, which we decided when we tend to do the sort of facet, we wouldn't do that. We would tend to work by discipline, and then within discipline we'd be faceting. So after that I got married, went away, did a lot of work actually when I was married with Gerald Pepperton at Cranfield.
Oh, so you actually worked with him?
Yes.
Yes.
On lots of the army evaluations. In the both Cranfield 1 and 2, I did help with that. And then Cyril was always thinking of new things he wanted to test or new research he had. He was wonderful in that way. And I attempted to help him. Either testing other systems or carrying out tests for some of the ideas that he had. So.
Jane, where were you located physically?
Oh, well, yeah, we were down in Luton at the time. And then I used to get people help us to come look after children. And I used to go off for the day to spend with Phil. And then come back at home to do the work. We thought we'd have a look at, and then went back maybe 2 weeks later to talk about it. Worked out how we did it.
So tell me something about Cleveland himself.
But he's very kind. He's a very kind man and very considerate. About the people who worked for him, which I was to be with. And he had a lovely wife, Mary, and three children. And they were all at Cranfield College, and they lived in a house quite near. And unhappily, one of his daughters committed suicide, but that's a lot later on, a terrible blazer.
He sounds as if he was full of ideas and very dynamic.
He was. I mean, apart from being such a kind and loving person, but he was just brilliant with a number of ideas that he had. And one always felt that it was difficult to keep up with him and to, you know, keep alongside thought.
Mm.
But it was quite a challenge.
Must have been very busy for you too, because you had young family.
Yeah, but that wasn't the only thing I was doing. You know, probably the doing other evaluations or so on and so forth. But it wasn't until about 1968 that I started to work on solar facets, because the librarian at the time, I think, was not John Marshall, Don Kennington. decided that I think he wanted a new edition, I think, of the publication, because I hadn't made the first one, he probably came back to me. And or maybe he wanted the thesaurus, I'm not quite sure which. But the idea came to me that we could make a thesaurus from the classification we had already. But then looking at the classification we had already, I realised all the faults that I told you about already.
Mm.
And decided to make a completely new system.
Tell me how you went about that.
That's fascinating, isn't it, really?
Well, I think that I obviously, one of the sources was the classification we already had, but another source which had come along was the big test engineering thesaurus. And I think I looked at that for additional terms what we had, because although the subject field of engineering, which I broadened it somewhat, not to be totally for mechanical and electrical engineering, but also other things. So it did take a long time, and we see in those days there was no mechanisation.
Mm.
And so...
Not even punch cards?
Oh, I didn't even have punch cards, no. No. I made a classification first, and from that I developed the alphabetical thesaurus, which is the way I always work anyway. But the alphabetical thesaurus was held in about 20-25 boxes, shoe boxes, around the spare bedroom. and the room had to be sort of locked sort of during the day, because we couldn't have children going in and setting the cards. I think I must have been working away for about 3 or 4 years. This eventually was published in 1969, towards the end of 69. I did have help from some of the staff at Whetstone, particularly Alan Gomsworth, who now, I think he's about to retire, but he works for the Sound Library. Alan Gomsworth. I think he's head of the of the South Island.
It's Sol, is it? I can't hear the last.
On the South.
South. Mm.
And he gets up on the mechanical engineering section.
Mm.
And I also got help with the computer section, which of course was fairly primitive at that time.
Mm.
And the Whetstone Library, the English Electric Company, they actually published the job, and it was a terribly long job. Problem, again, there wasn't any mechanisation.
So it was all hand typed?
It was all hand done.
Mm. What about your colleagues in CIG as you were developing this? How were they taking your ideas and so on? Because you must have been testing it out on them too.
I think they were a little bit astonished, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In what way were they?
I can't remember it. It's a long time ago.
Mm.
I suppose they were very supportive. But I probably was more concerned about how it was going to be at Whetstone and the English Electric Company, and how the engineers were going to get on with it, and so forth. But unfortunately, not very long after it was published and started to be used, the General Electric Company took over the English Electric Company and closed down all the libraries, really. The Whetstone Library, where I was, which had 30 staff, was more or less the library, the whole group was shut down, and there were only 5 people left. And of course it really died to death, or there weren't people who could update it.
Mm.
And so this is why it was a phenomenon. And in the world, you know, this is a marvelous thing. But it never was updated.
And I take it
and it's absolutely out of date now. It's an example of how one might lay something up, but has to be able to use it in any meaningful way.
Mm.
Not possible.
But for its time, it was a very unique.
Mm.
And of course there have been, but there are still, there's all I like it in existence, like the Luther story, which more or less has the same format, exactly, but that hasn't been updated since 1985. Up to about 2 years ago, I was still making Thesaurus like that, for that style. And there are one or two still about, Department of Employment and Education Employment in the other Thesaurus, in the same style. Mm.
So what happened to you after with this takeover?
Oh, well, I wasn't. That didn't matter to me because I was an independent consultant. So I went on and really to be making the story rather than doing any other sort of work. So I did do evaluations and that sort of thing. But mainly I was making the story from there on and went on to make the UNESCO before. And which was in the sort of originally, but it's no longer that way. And other ones I made from the Department of Health in England and the International Thesaurus of Refugee Terminology for UNHCR, which also may not still be with 2 years ago, 3 years ago, was in the Thesaurus as it was. And I made one for the Law Institute of International Affairs in London, which is still being used. And so on.
So what is the statement about this approach?
Yes, well, the form is that you get something that looks like a classification, which looks almost like a bliss classification system. Then in the display section of the thesaurus. And then there's the last critical one, which is derived from the classification. So you get the benefit of the classification system and the thesaurus together. Mm.
You were saying that the UNESCO one was a very political operation.
Well, I think it was political within UNESCO. Some other departments that had their own thesauri and didn't offer that the way it was produced. Mm. Or so that was really an internal political issue.
Didn't impinge on your
work? No, I just went on to do it.
So, then of course there's the Dorking Conference in 57 with Carlos Pitt. Then you've given us your reminiscence in the on the proceedings. Is there anything else that's come to mind about that conference?
Well, that was the time that the principles of, or the importance of scientific classification were set out. That's why it was was memorable. But I don't think I have any other recollections about it, apart from Jack Mills, when he was quite a young man, lecturing, and he was always so eloquent.
So let's come back to CIG and what's going on there, and then eventually to the new Bliss.
Oh, right, well. The CRG is still going strong, but mainly it is looking at the Bliss schedule as they're coming out. And Jack Mills will bring along his chemistry schedule and discuss or bring up the points he'll find it difficult. At the moment, Eric Coates is doing the technology schedule. And he is getting help from other members of the group. We're getting now towards the end of this classification, so I'm not quite sure what the CIG will discuss after that.
Is it recruiting new members?
Yes. There are some new members. Well, I can't tell you who they are.
Oh, no,
that's not fine.
It's just that,
It is going, sorry, I've got people coming in.
McElwain used to be the secretary, but of course she doesn't have time now. She's director of the UCL school. And so we're a bit lost without her because she used to do the minutes. And people who attend regularly are Of course, Jack Mills and Douglas Hopkins. And Eric Coates, I think. They are the main people. So I can tell you later who they are.
I went to a meeting. I don't think he was there. Quite a few years ago now, and I was preparing an edition of some travel diaries of John Metcalf. And Jack Mills and Douglas and a couple of people had read them and commented on them, and they invited me to come to a meeting and talk about the diaries and John Metcalf, because apparently there had been a notable meeting quite some years before, I think. With Metcalf, who polemical and against so much that happened in this country, and it was all for cover, and you know, it's sort of one of those silly polemical things. And it was for me the setting, because as people began to discuss Metcalf's ideas, and the discussion recapitulated the kind of discussion that Metcalf had actually reported.
I know they did.
I don't think
you do tend to go around in circles.
Well, yes, I mean, but this is because of Metcalf himself,
and his
limited view. So your connection then with Bliss is essentially in as far as CIG looking at the schedule?
No, I've always used Bliss as a source for my story, right back, you know, from the early, very early days, because they were faceted that and lots of the work that had been done, and they were fairly up to date. So certainly when I was doing the as a source for the Department of Health in the UK, I used the medical schedule. But the trouble was, of course, if you were doing all the subject fields, not all the subject fields had actually been done by Bliss, so you had to make your own for the fields that they hadn't done. that's why I came to be interested in it, and I certainly used the political schedules when I was doing the source for the Royal Institute of International Affairs, because their interest was politics and economics, and the best schedule for both was so good and so detailed. So we used them as a basis and altered them and added to them. So that's how I got to get into it.
The edition that you're using, who prepared that?
What, of the politics?
Yes, or of the schedules, because that wouldn't be the original place, would it?
No. I think the economics one was practically the one that eventually was the final one.
From the CIG itself?
The political one was a pre-version. It was a draft, really, but a fairly extended draft.
Again, a draft coming out of the deck?
A draft. No, they said it was a draft. And also, of course, law, which we had law in that one. So that they weren't... But that really didn't matter, because by the time I had dealt with it, it was very different. But it was such a good basis to start with, because I added quite a different type of notation. And then there was always the peculiarities that the clients need.
The
clients need.
Yes, of course.
Always. So we weren't just producing, it was just giving us a start, really. But prior to a lot of the detail, we did retain. It was in economics and politics.
Did the work that you do in its turn feed back into the further development of the Bliss schedule?
Well, I think you probably have copies of what we've done, but I can't tell you what we did or not. That's up to Jack.
Yes.
So that's how I have always been involved in Bliss, I suppose. From the very beginning, and Jack has sometimes written me special schedules when I've asked him.
Oh,
yes, but he hadn't. Well, when we needed international law, he wrote me a special schedule for me, or us only. Mind you, since then, of course, he's done a much more elaborate one, but So it was the he was very generous in that way, in helping.
So eventually I'm now on the committee, but I haven't been on very long.
Mm.
I can't tell you too much about it, but there's a lot of interest in Bliss in the University Library of Cambridge. And Heather Lane of the Sydney Sussex College is now the rector of it. And I think she has programmes. So it's hopeful that there are lots of new people getting interested in this, but certainly not enough people, and there certainly isn't enough money going into it, and not enough others.
Mm. Is it something that could be used, you think, in this new internet and web environment?
That's absolutely. Mm. But so they just haven't the money or the staff to sort of press for it to be used.
Mm.
And the number of libraries using it are fairly small. But I think that people making for SOI may be using them as a source, maybe using it as a source of relationship, a source of hoping.
You think, given all that in the web itself, that somebody would see.
You think so? I mean,
putting money into developing, helping to develop it.
I mean, the UDC and Jimmy and other systems already being used on the web, something to organise. Things to organise like web pages. So, that's why they shouldn't be.
But I think Aya, as you know, Aya Musselbain is director of the UDC, I suppose.
Yes, she's chairman of the committee.
And she and Nancy Williamson, of course, use Bliss to update the medical section of UDC. Whether how are they getting on with it, I don't know, because I have written papers, but I have not been following that recently.
Interesting sort of cross.
Yeah, do you know that?
Germination,
you
know that? No, I didn't know that, no.
No, well, I mean, I think in the book of Robin, that's what I'm telling you about, that the in here about the Bliss on the floor.
I'll take the details of that too.
You really ought, because
make sure.
More of what I'm saying is in there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So you must have seen an incredible amount of changes in just the physical application of the SOI now, given that you started in the print world,
well,
and then sort of online world, and now to the World Wide Web world.
Yes, oh, it's such a help. I must say that people have got such bad writing. It's marvellous how anybody ever read the cards that I wrote, but I had some good secretaries who were able to decipher it. But obviously now I never write anything, and it saves so much time. But I suppose I've been using Thor's software for quite a while now. It's only recently that I've had software which does produce Thor-Fasset style printout.
Did you have a hand in the development of this, or is it just...
Well, yes and no, really. I mean, not, no, I don't have any computer expertise, but I did sort of hawk the idea around to various people, hoping they would do something for me. And eventually I found a firm who would.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask me for the name, because it's gone out of my head. But I did develop it, and I did use it for quite a number of SOI, and then I found another specialist who made it rather better. So, I do have some software now, but there ought to be many, a much better one, and more, one that anyone can buy, and it isn't. And it's really been made for my use.
Well, clearly that's one of your major things, given the number of SOI that you've what you've been mentioning in our conversation.
I'm no longer making for SOI, so then...
Oh, you're not?
No. Well, no. I have stopped some time. So I think I did a last update of the source about a year ago.
You've decided to retire.
Well, I think, I think it was the time that there isn't really a programme to carry on making the SOI in the root style anymore. So I'll just stop.
Mm.
But
they do have the Department of Education and Employment, they do have a copy of this software, but it doesn't get anybody else. Hmm.
What is the style now? You say it's...
Well, I can show you.
Yes.
Yes, fix them up. No, don't. I have to think about that. No, don't.
Oh, yes.
And, but she's retired now. She's retired.
Yeah, I think. Do you know Elaine Spinonius?
Yes.
Well, he's an old, very
yes,
close sir. Friend of mine. We were PhD students together at the University of Chicago. She mentioned to me, I think, that Inga tried to look at Dahlberg, isn't it?
Yes, but you don't want to go Inga.
Yeah. She retired, and I think it was Michelle Bitches.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that was it. Really, but one of the other, she was very good at it. But she had tended to have her own way and her own facets. Ideas of, you know, her own orders and facets and so on is rather different than anybody else's, and she produced her own international classification, which is used in UNESCO still, I think, for the bibliography section.
Yes.
And but she was actually a philosopher as well, and as well as being kind of a linguist. But without her, ISCO wouldn't have happened.
Mm. And you think it's played an important role
in really
keeping
doing.
Classification alive?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, with a big conference coming up in a day or two in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
You know about that?
I don't.
So it's the main ISCO conference. Mm. This year it's in Toronto from July or something. Any minute now. Most people are going to it. And sort of keep track on what on new publications in the bibliography. Mm. One thing about it. The Stephen Pollard.
Mm.
Well, he has done special programs to search databases using the classification system.
No.
Well, it's kind of been there as in the bibliography.
Yes, I'll look
for him.
Yeah.
Mm. But he's quite important in the UK representative. They are checks for him. He's at Huddersfield University.
Mm.
In the computer section.
Mm. Oh, in the computer section, I see.
Yes.
It's some of those links, I think, that might lead to the moving into this new computer environment, the knowledge in the other environment. is interview with Tom Edgerson, side one. Tom, tell me a little bit about your background, educational background and things of that kind, and about how you became involved with this field, and I suppose with science abstracts as it was then, in particular.
Fine. First of all, I was born in Glasgow, in Scotland, in 1923. I then moved up at age of three to Dundee, and went to school there. Then I went to St Andrews and got a BSc in Physics and Mathematics at St Andrews University in 1944, and then went to the Admiralty Signal and Radar Establishment in Haslemere in England. This was during the war, and I, as part of my time on physics, I'd had some extra radar training, and so I went to the Admiralty Signal and Radar Establishment in Haslemere instead of going into the army. Or at least I was in the army for a short time, but was taken out to do this instead. So I was there as doing radar research for 3 years, and then in 1948. At the end of the war, and when I was able to get out of what I was doing, I went as a librarian to Courtaulds Limited in Braintree, Essex.
How did you get involved with libraries if you were coming out of that sort of background?
Well, the main point was that I realised I'd wanted to be to have a degree in either classics or English. But because the war was on, I was given a large bursary, or what seemed a large bursary at the time, to do physics instead, mainly because I hadn't done any physics or chemistry for some years at school, but I'd done a lot of extra maths, because that fitted in nicely with the Greek I was doing. So I found myself doing physics at university and having to catch up with people who've been doing it for 6 years. Anyway, they worked out not too badly. But I realised that I didn't want to be a physicist. I didn't want to work in a laboratory. And I hadn't got that sort of type of mind. I'd done it much more as an intellectual exercise rather than breathing it. So I saw this job for Courtauld. Is this all right? This is not too prolix, this is the thing.
No, let's keep on going, and I'll just give you a portion.
You can take,
that I wanted to move on. I think
please.
These sorts of origins are very interesting, because how do people get involved in things, and then off, and after a period, it's perhaps not as interesting, because, you know, it's defined institutionally in a way.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, let's keep on. So you got involved with Courtaulds.
Well, are you recording?
Yep.
Very sorry. Courtauld had advertised for an indexer, they said, and in their library, and that sounded the sort of thing I might be able to do, because I didn't know anything about libraries, but I'd used them a lot. And when I got there, I found that what they really meant was librarian, because they didn't have anybody else. So it was a one-man, well, it was a girl there helping. It was a one-man band, basically. So I had to learn about libraries very quickly and what to do, to work out my way around and to do the indexing and classification and all the rest of it as best I could. And I realised I then had to be sensible to learn about libraries, so I started doing the Library Association correspondence course and then took the examinations. And they found that I'd been doing not too badly, but there was other things they obviously could teach me, and it was much better. So that continued until 1955, and then I felt that the library was very good, and I could answer all the questions that I was asked. comparatively easily, and really needed to extend myself. I should have gone a little bit before that. Anyway,
In the library, were you doing any special kind of information service?
Yes, I was providing a sort of full information service, in the sense that people were coming in asking questions and I was answering them. And by that time, I had a fair knowledge of the field, the textile research field. And I was also doing a lot of editing. They produced a fair number of reports and also a fair number of papers. And I was doing the editing of these too. So it was an enjoyable place because it was a textile research laboratory and there was a small, comparatively small number of persons at the time, mm-hmm. clientele. So I then looked round and saw a job going with the British Aircraft Corporation. This was on guided missiles.
Uh-huh.
And so I went there. This was then in Luton initially. And then they opened a new place in Stevenage, then closed the Luton one. And so we all moved to Stevenage. And here I was a divisional librarian and information officer, it was then called. So we were doing a considerable amount of straightforward librarianship, with increasing amounts of information work, particularly when we went beyond the guided weapons to satellites.
When you say information work, what do you mean? I mean, what were the sorts of things that you were doing that was different from the library side?
People would be asking questions about what was there available on, and we'd be making searches of the particular subject fields. In the meantime, they would be quite often going to their fellow workers and getting information from them. So it was quite often, it was an interesting rush to see whether you could get the information before they got it elsewhere. And that developed quite a bit. Then,
can I just ask you about that? Did you provide them just with bibliographic references, or did you actually provide them with answers to the questions, in extent?
Very rarely the real answers to the questions, because that was always going to be a little bit risky. Most of the time it would be, but if you were lucky, you could pinpoint them and say, this is the paragraph in such and such a paper that's going to answer your question. Right. That was when you really had hit mother load, as it were. In the meantime, I got involved with the ASLIP aircraft group, information group. There was Cyril Cleverton and various other people involved, and that developed a friendship between Cyril and me, and between my wife and me, and between my wife and him. And I became secretary in various things of the group, and got more involved with ASLIP. And at the same time, that's right, I went to an ASLIP conference and was chairing one of the sessions, and this had a fellow from IBM who was talking about SDI.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they had, as far as I know, IBM had coined SDI. I'm not sure. Anyway, this I found tremendously attractive. It seemed a wonderful idea, and I went back and thought I'd try and put it into the library. The only thing wrong with it, of course, was they didn't have any access to computers at that stage. They were using computers extensively on the site, but not, but that was for missile guidance and things like that, nothing to do with the library. But I liked the idea, and I liked the idea of the feedback on forms as opposed to odd remarks made in the library. So I set up a manual SDI system, but using the forms as though it was with a computer, and sending people stuff out and so on. And found that this was greeted with great enthusiasm. And people liked it very much. And of course it had the great advantage that because it was manual, I only did it for a comparatively small number of people initially, and because it was manual, and that it was being done by an individual, and I knew the individuals, I could tailor it exactly to what they wanted. And for instance, my classic one was where I was sending the head of our electronics group a paper on an ABC of electronics, which looked as though it was the last thing that you would want to do, was to get everyone to keep their job. But I knew that he was going to a women's group to be talking about electronics in general and some things. And this book worked very well, so I sort of had that idea in my mind for some time.
So you then had access to photocopying equipment?
Oh yes, yes,
so you're doing a lot of
I was headhunted from there. The director of engineering, L.H. Bedford, a famous engineer in this country, was on a committee which was setting up a new organisation called the National Electronics Research Council under the chairmanship of Lord Mountbatten. And he was asked, did he know anybody who would do a technical job with an information interest. And he thought of me and put my name forward with a glowing report, which surprised me considerably, because the only time I'd ever had dealings with him was when he kept swearing at me, because he used to use electrical engineering abstract extensively, and he never got used to the idea that the numbers in the index were to the abstracts and not to the pages, and he used to regularly not find the thing he wanted and throw it at me in the library. That was my impression of him, that he was obviously a different impression of me. Anyway, so I went to the National Electronics Research Council, which was really just starting up. There was me as its one member of staff, and attached to the British International, British IRE, Institution of Radio Engineers, that's right. And I was there for 2 years, and during that time developed a number of things like a journal moved them towards the idea of doing something about information. They were really concerned with looking after research in this country, and the idea was to see if they could coordinate it and so on.
Did they have funds to allocate for research
projects? No, not at that stage at all. They were doing it entirely on the basis that Lord Mountbatten was well known as the Queen's uncle, or Prince Philip's uncle, and he was able to get all the heads, all the chairmen of all the electronic groups, all the electronic companies, all the heads of departments and of government, all the heads of the universities, and all the government research laboratory heads, directors, and get them all in. We had our list of members of council was quite wonderful, because it was full of sirs and lords and so on like that. And I had an information committee we'd set up, and they suggested that we ought to be doing something about what could we do to help research workers. So then I produced my idea of SDI, and they thought this was a great idea. And it happened that one of the people on our research committee was a member of OSTI, which is the Office for Scientific and Technical Information. And over lunch one day, I was talking about SDI and we ought to do something about it. And he said, why don't you set up a research project? And this was very early days of, Cyril was getting money from America.
Yeah, thanks for the NSF.
NSF, very much so, yes. And but it was not at all a common thing.
Mm.
And so I remember going away and thinking, this is exciting, and writing a proposal, and after it had been reviewed and dealt with, we eventually got money to do work on it. And that was some months to look at if an SDI project was possible, feasible, how to do it properly.
So that was the research project?
The research project. And that was, and we then recruited an assistant, and for me, and there's another members of staff to do the critical work and so on. And the project eventually, once we put in our report on the experimental part of it, it was agreed that we would do a proper research project, and that was the one that where we had 800 people looking at taking SDI and going on for some years. Anyway,
that was through the council.
No, the council, we got so far, and if I remember rightly, but we hadn't got agreement on the research project. And at that time, it was decided that there had been interactions with the IE, with Science Abstract, because Brit IRE was in opposition to IE, at least they were a different group. Yes, going to the same well, and you obviously have problems with that. And
could you explain that a bit more? Because the institution, the
IEE is the one who have science abstracts.
Then you had the council that you were part of.
Yes, which was very much associated with the British IRE.
The Institute of Radio Engineers.
That's right.
I see. So,
and
so that the what became the IEEE?
No. IEEE is the American.
The IEEE.
That was there. Had been there for a long time.
Right.
Long
but time. It was not a member of your research council.
No.
Because for the way you spoke, it seemed as if everybody,
yes, but
not them.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? They were not.
As far as I remember, they were. Certainly, there were. There was connections because the people in Brit IRE and a lot of the other members of the council were members of the council of the IE.
Mm.
So there was. Everything was known about him. So.
Coming back to your project,
the main point was that Lord Mountbatten decided that he could really. Oh, yes, that's right. The other thing we had decided to do was to produce a current papers in electronics, current papers in electronics research. And this was going to clash very much with what the IE were proposing and said it started off earlier. But some questions to who did what first, and I think Lord Mountbatten and some other people felt that he didn't want the hassle, and there seemed some doubt as to whether any RC would get any money from government to do the grandiose schemes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was persuaded that it would be a good thing if the NERC work was merged with the IE, Science Abstracts. So my deputy and I who were the two members of staff, find ourselves passed to the IE. There's no question of anyone asking us would we like to do it or anything similar. This was just, this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found myself, so that was one aspect of it. Yeah? The other one was that I'd been very much connected with OSTI in the working out these terms. And they were in process of funding the IE to mechanise science abstracts. But they had comparatively little faith in how they were going about it. They felt they were dragging their feet, and because the science abstracts to a large extent had been pushed into further mechanisation by the Americans, the IP and the Physical Society. So they had arranged for the secretary of the institution and a deputy secretary, who became the first director of INSPEC, as it turned out, J.R. Smith, to go to America to see various things, including people doing typesetting at MIT. And they wanted somebody to make sure they did the right thing, and so they arranged for me to go with them.
So this is very soon after you'd actually been transferred?
No, this is before I'd been transferred.
Even before?
Before I'd been transferred. Okay. I was going there as their spy in the camp or whatever. So I found myself...
You're the Aussie mole.
That's right. But before we set off on our journey, I'd been transferred.
Mm-hmm.
So I found myself negotiating where I fitted into the IE in a taxi in New York.
Okay.
With the secretary, and it's not, and at breakfast and various other times, and I can assure you it's not a great way. You don't have all that many things in your favour under these circumstances. So anyway, I was taken on the IE and decided that I'd be concerned with information research.
Tom, before... Just to clarify, when you were taken on, you were also bringing with you the SDI research project, is that right?
Yes.
So in a sense, you would have had that money and that project as
No, we didn't have the project yet, you see. It hadn't been approved. Everybody said they liked it, but nobody... There was a question of who was going to pay for it and how was it going to be paid. And as a pattern, no, that's the way it went.
So everything indeed was up in the air. Right?
Everything was still up in the air, oh yes, very much so. And I joined, and then INSPEC was... Can you stop for a minute? My impression was that it gave us confidence that it was possible to do good attack setting. I think this was the great thing that came out of it.
Mm.
That we could see it working. Had discussions with people at MIT. There was some question as to whether we would go down their road and engage them. But in fact, we ended up doing it ourselves. But it certainly, this confidence building one, because there was some, all the way through the INSPEC project, it was very much a matter of persuading people that such things were possible. And then the great danger was that once you persuaded them it was possible, they thought things were more possible than they actually were.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And we came back, and that was, I think, 1967. And INSPEC
was George Gainsborough in 1966. The creation of INSPEC was from 1st of January 1967, and that was as the Information Service in Physics, Electric Technology and Control. And when that was set up, I became my Information Research Manager, and David Martin became Information Systems Manager. So we were the two, and the director, J.R. Smith. And he was the one who was basically concerned with developing the new system.
So INSPEC itself was created really to become a mechanized version of science assets.
That's right. In the meantime, of course, we as INSPEC were developing the system, but science abstracts were a separate group of people continuing to do the normal work at the minor system. So it was gradually over a period of time David developed the system, and then we tried it out, and then for a time it ran a mechanized system and a manual one, and then the manual one was dropped. It was all mechanized. The important part here is that when David Martin was developing the system or designing it, he was very, very careful to make sure that they did all the things that a database does properly, so that he insisted that all the input should be such that it would be then very easy to either publish abstract journals, publish current papers, do online, initially mechanized services, and then online, and had this vision of people sitting at the terminal and getting information from the database. Now that was quite exceptional, because a number of other people mechanized their publications, and that was true in America, certainly in chemical abstracts, and so on. And so we were very early in having this totally mechanized database.
Did you have, I'm just trying to think of the dates for ChemAbs and some of those other services. Had they begun this process a bit before you?
Chemical Abstracts had mechanized their chemical papers or something like that.
Yeah, I was just wondering.
The people who were first were Medlars and NASA. As part of my time at NERC, I had a trip to the United States, where I saw all the good things that were happening in most of them in America, and because I had to go on to Canada to meet Lord Mountbatten, because he was making a presentation to the National Research Council, and I was to help him answer the questions. So
what was it like working with somebody like Lord Mountbatten?
Fascinating. Hard work. Yes, he eventually, during the NERC time, he produced a paper on SDI. He gave a lecture to the Royal Institution in London on SDI. I wrote it, and then he gave the same paper to the National Research Council of Canada. The one in the Royal Institution one was one of their Friday night lectures, where the lecture has to last for an hour, has to have no introduction, there's no questions afterwards, and everybody sits in dinner jackets. So anyway, so as I say, the NASA already had the database.
Oh yes, for the nuclear science abstract.
Exactly.
Yeah.
NASA, the Sorry, the Nucleus.
Oh, that was the National.
Yes, and that's where Nucleus Science Abstracts came along.
Because it would have been very.
That was early too, yes, but NASA was the one that.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes. And there was. Yes. Medlars certainly were the ones who could show you how well you could do publishing an abstract, that sort of thing. And at NASA, very much. And then I went to a number of the other places, but depends and so on. Not getting close, I'd say. Anyway, but it was very good that we were able to do this. And the science abstract problem that David found with his board was that they weren't too sure how it was going to work, and then he produced a sample, about 12 pages, something similar, and showed them that it worked, upon which they said, very good, now you've got this deadline to do the 3 lots of science abstracts, do the 3 term papers at the same time. And the board nearly managed to scupper the whole project, because it became a very close-run thing whether we would manage it.
Given the time we,
yes. Or no, but just it became so complex.
Yeah.
And we went through a period when we were putting stuff in, but it wasn't very clear where it was going to, because nothing seemed to be coming out of the system at the end. Anyway, worked out successfully, and you want a date of that. Then stop again, you'll find it.
So what was the date was?
The date of starting the mechanized science abstracts was 1st of January 1969. Mm-hmm. And one very interesting thing then was, of course, that we'd had the question of the indexing that was going to be used with it. We already had indexing to produce the indexes to the 6 monthly abstract journals and so on, but there was a question of what we should do, particularly for online searching or mechanized searching. So that was when we started the DEVIL project.
Oh yes. Mm-hmm.
The Direct Evaluation of Indexing Languages, and we looked at title abstract, controlled language, and pre-indexing, and the indexing that they were already using for science abstracts. And that was very much my baby at the time, and very much dependent on how Cranfield, how Cyril Cleverton had done Cranfield.
Mm.
And so at one stage I knew more about Cranfield, I think, than anybody except Cyril perhaps did, because I was following it too hard. And found a whole host of problems that obviously he'd had in the test, and came out with results that were slightly different from his, and because found that controlled language was, it seemed better than anything else, and giving the sort of balance between recall and precision, and but the next best was the pre-indexing.
Mm-hmm.
And because I couldn't see how we would get the same control, the control language that we've been using had been done just by a small number of people who were sitting really in 4 desks facing each other, so there was very close control of it. And when you go into 30 information scientists, I didn't see that the control was going to be there, and it was also going to be very much more expensive.
So those 4 people didn't have a thesaurus that they were working on. They must have had a list of something.
Well, they had a list, yeah. They had a list, and they had a thesaurus of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so I decided, or put forward the idea, that we ought to go for the pre-indexing, because it had a number of advantages. It would also be easier to do, be quicker, and it's going to also use the words that were used by the scientists rather than some proxy of it. And we'd also, when we went to SDI or anything similar, or for actually searching, the user would be able to put in his own words, because that the pre-indexing would be using the words that he would use himself. So we did that. When I was looking back before you came, I was just surprised how quickly, first of all, the text went on forever, because it was fairly large, or so it seemed to me. But once we decided, the pre-indexing was incorporated into the inspect tapes very, very quickly, without serious problem. Everybody liked it, you know, which was a great thing.
And but it so wasn't instead of the other, was it? You had them both?
We had them both, yes. Exactly, yes, yes.
So you had the...
We had the classification and the control language. There was still the indexes for the abstract journals. These were still being produced. But the expectation, and it turned out, was that the pre-indexing is the one that the mechanized searching and online searching would use. In the meantime, the SDI project had started, and had, as I say, it had 800 people, and went on for a couple of years, and was very successful in the sense that got a lot of people, real research workers and engineers, very interested in it, and did it, and regularly gave us feedback. They went surprisingly well in that we, very few people fell out. We had a couple of times the embarrassment of the widow writing saying, "I'm very sorry, my husband can't continue his date." And that, eventually by that time I'd pass it on to my deputy then, Peter Clegg, to complete the work, and he wrote the report. And we then decided that we would offer SDI to as part of the inspect. And that had a fairly checkered career.
Is that when you started that to offer it on, first of all, on cards?
Yes, we've been offering it on cards as part of the other things, yes, of the test. And the test, after all, was 800 profiles is large scale. We never got anything like that thereafter when we were doing it commercially. And we were into smaller numbers. And I've never been able to simply understand why SDI didn't do better. And I haven't got an answer to that at all. Because everything about it was convinced us in the test.
But didn't subsequently you published, they're like standard profiles.
That's right, yes.
Sort of 6 or 8 or 12
topics.
How many?
Yes, we did topics.
So it, in a way...
That worked out very well. That was something that was quite successful, yes. But that in a sense was perhaps easier for people to subscribe to. The other one was going to require them to put a fair bit of thought in, and more importantly, the expectation that they would actually read what came out. Yes, because it ended up, it still confirmed me that given a fair wind, people will avoid information rather than rush to it. So, anyway, now we've got, I'm not sure where we've got to.
Tom, there was a major process of kind of revision of classification and language control and so on from the physical abstracts days to InSpec. The UDC, I think, was used initially for the classification of science abstracts. and then presumably at some point was abandoned. So I wondered what the story was there. And then there was a research project, I think, that you must have managed to produce a unified classification. I think...
Okay. The UDC had been used by Science Abstracts for some time. But particularly as time went on, it was realized that UDC was not being kept up to date and that it was a cumbersome thing to use for the classification of materials in the detail that was required. And so it was decided that in 1967 it should be ceased to be used, and that coincided with the starting of the mechanized service, so that the mechanized service never actually used UDC. Then as time went on, as we got used to the mechanized service and the developing the operation, it became clear that there was great advantages in not doing anything more than once. Up to then, we had congratulated ourselves on producing the same abstract for all of the services, whereas once upon a time, when the science abstract, when there was physics abstracts and electrical engineering abstracts, if anything was required for both services, it was treated as a new document and done again.
So it was abstracted twice?
It was abstracted twice. This was something that was stopped, obviously, when we did the mechanized science abstracts. But we still had the problem that we were classifying for physics and classifying for electrical and electronic abstracts and computer and control abstracts. It was an obvious thing to do, to bring the three classifications together and produce a unified classification. It was obvious, but it took a fair bit of time to do it. And in the process of that, we had various inputs from AIP on the classification of physics and so on, which got quite involved. For the thesaurus, we had started a thesaurus in comparatively early days as part of our research project, and developed that. And the thesaurus, I think, all of the time really was something that we looked upon as covering the whole INSPEC database. So that developed. It was. Didn't conform to all the thesaurus principles that my wife espoused, but obviously worked reasonably well, and still going strong, still being used.
But Jean wasn't involved in the development of this thesaurus?
Not of that thesaurus, no. She was concerned with some parts of indexing material when Science Abstract was still being a publication. She was concerned then, but not thereafter. No.
So there's another matter I was just curious about too. The relationship with the American Institute of Physics and the cross I suppose constant interaction across the.
That was always a very difficult. Thing for us. We were conscious of the fact that we were a British organisation and a British electrical engineering organisation who were producing a physics database for the whole world, and the AIP, and perhaps the Physical Society, but not so obviously, but AIP quite clearly felt that it would be much more sensible, or God had ordained it really, that it should be done by Americans rather than Britons. And So there was this constant concern and unhappiness. I don't think they saw an easy way of doing it and producing a physical abstract.
We are beginning to talk about the relationship with AIP.
Oh yes, with AIP. The, we had... AIP had very regular meetings with IE to discuss developments with science abstracts. There'd been a committee set up to control the physics abstracts part of science abstracts long before the mechanisation, so I've been continuing on that basis.
This is a committee that included people from the AIP.
That's right, yes, a joint committee. With the setting up of the mechanised service, they were also involved and would have regular meetings with us. Invariably, the meetings were difficult. They were unhappy about, I think, the lack of control of the service rather than the service itself. And there was considerable concern about what they ended up with author abstracts. They were firmly of the belief that author abstracts were part of the total copyright, and whether that should be made available freely, and this disagreement developed in such a way that in 1973 AIP withdrew permission for INSPEC to use author abstracts for all AIP journals, so that from 1974 INSPEC discontinued the use of author abstracts from all AIP journals and re-abstracted them themselves, which was quite, you know, because unfortunate.
And that would be a major task because of size of publishing of
the AIP. Yes, it wasn't easy. We had to pick up the ball and run with it fast.
Did that affect the subscription cost? I mean, the cost must have escalated considerably.
Yes. No, we managed to do it. We didn't. We couldn't afford to show there was anything different going on. I mean, the whole essence with the database, and we had a very good reputation at that time, was that everything was fine. Trust us. So, no, that continued for a very long time. One of the worries that was constantly with us was what would happen if AIP set up in opposition, and what would that do to INSPEC's viability. And my time as director, I was pursued with the board saying, it's all very well, you're doing very well now, but what about in 10 years' time? I felt that they didn't know about, in their own businesses, what was going to happen in 10 years' time, but they still, it was this AIP, always on the horizon, as it were.
So when AIP went, it was at this time going through the same sort of mechanisation process for the publication of its journals, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right.
There was that major research project that Pauline Cochrane was involved in.
That's right.
Stella Keane, I think, was assistant.
That's right, yes.
And, I mean, it would have made such sense just simply to supply the journals or the abstracts even in machinery will form.
Yes.
But because of this problem...
This didn't help, was it?
So this didn't happen.
So when
did the this disagreement get resolved, or has it? It has been resolved, has it?
I started to think of this. And then we arrived Tripoli as well.
Yes. So I mean, there's the Sitka through connection.
We're on again.
I've just heard right. Yes. Yeah.
As our relationship with AIP became less friendly, we developed a much closer relationship with IEEE, and IEEE basically were happy to go along with, for the most part, the inspect database. And in fact, they became our agents, and we became their agents. And for the primary publications, and we became agents for the secondary publications as well. And we eventually set up an office in Piscataway, which was the IEEE complex there. And so that worked very well, and they provided us with abstracts and things like that, actually. This Carl Strew, we had interactions with. They, of course, were, in a sense, had Physikalische Berichte, and that was competitive with physics abstracts. We had various interactions, lots of meetings with them to work out how we could amalgamate or do things together or what way. I just can't remember the detail of it. It would be unfair to say something that simply could easily not be true. But that was another dimension that was a sort of cloud on the horizon again. And then, of course, it became even more of a cloud when they sent up STN, because then AIP was feeding things into STN, and there was a question of was Inspect going to be squeezed out in any way. But as things went on, most of these problems were resolved partly by, I think, people either retiring or changing and so on. And
who were the people that you were dealing with at the AIP?
Bill Koch was the main, was the director. And he was the one who had the strong views, actually. A number of people came through. Sometimes we got very close to agreeing things, and then it fell apart again. I don't think we were not all sweetness and light, in the sense that the IE had science abstracts for a long time. Were happy with it, wanted to keep it, and basically didn't want anyone else coming into their field as well.
To what extent were some of these problems and decisions commercial?
Well, they were all commercial. Oh, no, that's not fair. They were, a lot of them had a commercial bias, but other ones, as I think quite often in the information field, very much people wanting do it for their own aggrandizement. They can see it as something that they'd rather like to do and they'd rather like to hear or something similar.
So eventually STN was really more became a host, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was a host.
So that you presumably, Inspect would be available
But at one time, there was a question of, I mean, it started off very much with as chemical abstracts, another part of chemical abstracts, as it were, or another part of the online access to chemical abstracts. It was at that stage there was a question of whether the AIP would feed the material in.
Interesting to follow up that relationship with the AIP. Where it's ended up.
So coming back to the online, at that period, you know, when things were really starting and your, you know, the research work was progressing, was also the time when things like UNISYST were getting underway, the UNESCO ICSU
UNESCO ICSU ABE.
What contacts you folk had with that?
J.R. Smith, the director, the original director of INSPEC, he eventually went to Biosys as head of research. He was very much involved with youth of UNISYST, or what was the previous one, SS, and I gave papers at conferences but was never involved as a member of the committee. I very much was concerned with either a rival of it, not sure what, things like UCIDIC, the European one. Thesis, I went to quite a bit. And that piece, I guess, very much more. Yes, it did a fair number of things, and it was certainly a useful overall, at one stage of thesis. I think in the XOAB, it's the trial, and perhaps the UNISYS, I'm not sure. But the XOAB, I could see its role.
Yeah.
Very clearly,
yeah.
And it useful work then.
Well, I noticed too that at some point INSPEC began to incorporate the indexing of chemical numerical data.
Yes.
And I wondered, you know, what was involved with that, and to the extent that brought you in contact with CoData. That seems to have been a major development.
That data was later, and it was basically doing it to suit our customers as an international team, in a sense. And it was a major step, and that's really that it required considerable effort on behalf of the international scientists.
That's what the systems development.
That's right. Yeah, not that's what the systems development, but the actual putting the material in.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. But that was an addition very much to the work.
Did that bring you into some conflict with ChemEd?
No. We were doing it, that was the thing, we were doing it as a means of physics and electrical and electronics and other people using the data rather than chemists using the data or anything like that. They would obviously have gone to chemical abstracts, not to us. So it was showing people that it was data rather than anything else.
Oh, I see.
That had always been the problem, in the sense that produce the abstract and how do we get over to the journal. We looked at various things and had arrangements with some people for a short time. But I think we put a lot of the
emphasis on the IE library,
providing material, particularly the electrical engineering material, which obviously they were quite expensive. I don't think we ever resolved it.
I'm also curious about this, but you were actually acquiring all those journals, weren't you?
Yes.
So they would have been housed in the library?
No, the library got its own copies of the journals.
So what happened to the...
We tore them up.
literally.
Really?
Yeah, only in the sense that the, so that the institute, the, I don't know if we've got the evidence, we, everything, each article was a separate thing, it was a separate item. And so it went into a paper, into a plastic bag, and was dealt with as an article. So that's why we, that was not the reason why we not weren't able to provide the material, but that was how the thing worked.
The production process.
Yes, the production process. It was, the, one of the things about science abstracts was that it had always, from the early days, it had been done on the cheap, in the sense that everything was looked at to see what was the minimum effort that could be put in. And this worked out extremely well, because for instance, when they took the, split up the journal into the separate articles, they then could use the article. You weren't transcribing the title, you marked up the title on the on the page of the article, how it was going to be
input,
and things like that, you see.
And then they,
whereas in the early days of the American ones, of the organizations in particular, they used to have, if you remember, these lovely big input sheets with boxes to put in letters in each of the boxes so that the keyboarder could easily type it in. Mm. And you still got that occurring in some places. But obviously that means that you're doing everything twice, at least, with all the resulting errors that are bound to occur. This way, when our proofreaders came to check what was, what had been input, they'd only the one thing to look at.
So the keyboard has worked actually from the...
From that, itself. And then of course you had another page with all the additional information that we put on.
And then, just physically, how was the abstract then attached? Or?
Well, the abstract, there would be an abstract in the paper.
Oh, the author abstract, yes.
The author abstract, and that would then be edited. No, it would be edited by the information scientist to, first of all, to make sure that it was a fair, it seemed a fair representation of the paper, but more importantly that it was written in a sort of inspect way, style, so that it would make some alterations that way. And then they would be adding re-indexing and all the other bits and pieces, data and so on. That would be on a separate sheet.
But they would mark up the abstract actually on the page.
On the page, that's right, yes.
So they weren't retaking.
Yeah.
So dialogue was one of the early ones, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
So you were a major,
oh, yes.
A major databases for dialogue.
Yes. Yes, we had a long continuing relationship with that one. Yes.
Can you remember how all that developed?
It developed very early. Roger came to see us, and
Roger Summit.
Roger Summit, yes, and we would. Yes, I think 1969, 1970. We were out then on to, 1970 or 71, we were on dialogue.
Yeah.
Yes. And away we went. And that was fine, and we developed on a large number of other hosts, of course. And that proliferated quite remarkably and very successfully.
How was the financing of that done? Terribly. Both they and you had to get something from this.
Yes, we got royalties from them.
So for every abstract that was...
I'm trying to think now. I'm sorry. We we provided them with the tape. They they gave access and reported on usage that had been made of the tape and gave us appropriate money as a result of it. It was one of the things that used to worry our accountants, not our accountants, but, well, the people who were checking our financial results, because they wanted to know how could we prove that this money had been properly spent and so on. And they, yes, that, in the early days, of course, one couldn't clearly see how this was going to operate. And I remember at one stage having another online, potential online host discussing with us how much he would charge us for putting our database up, and then with the expectation that we would get the money back. Which way you did it. I think it was a very fruitful relationship we had with Dialogue, and then with a fair number of other people. The Dialogue was always tended to be our largest one. But it was in the early, and it was very comprehensive.
Yes, I bet it was for a long time. Yeah. Such an important component of that.
But we ended up with fair numbers of
I've seen a list somewhere of the hosts now.
Yes, that's fine.
So I suppose then the next development was CD-ROM.
Transferring the database to CD-ROM and distributing it. That's right. And that took a fair bit of time to, because this was on, in my days as director, took a fair bit of time to come round to doing it, because it was quite clearly that it was going to make a difference to a number of aspects, particularly online usage and so on. So that was, it evolved over time rather than anything else.
How did it affect your print?
The print runs kept, well, of course, you see now, I can't tell you over the last 12 years. It wasn't, we were having, there was a decline in the print runs continually over time. There were not so many people coming along new. When you had the large libraries keeping going, I think the CD-ROM, then the effect of that, which happened after my time, really.
Because I think the CD-ROM is probably the major decline.
Yes, I'm sure.
Because the equivalent of having the print on the electronic,
that's
right. Right there on
the BLR. British Library at that up at Boston Spa. They did an enormous amount of the document supply for people coming from our database, but not, we hadn't a particular relationship with them. It was, they were there supplying the world, as it were, for all the journals, and they obviously had our list of journals, knew which ones we were taking, and as they were seeking to be comprehensive, the expectation was that they would do the same thing themselves, if they could.
Well, I was interested because, given that there was, I don't know how you pronounce this, but it may have come in just after you, I'm not sure, it's asked IEEE or something.
Oh yes.
And that seemed to be a document supply service. That
This is after my time. Yes, there's a
with the ability to provide material more easily in various forms. I think the document supply service is going on and on.
Mm.
But whether they're supplying it as paper documents or otherwise, it's another matter, you see.
Yes. It's because they get scanned and sent down the line. Or,
yes, yes. Yeah. Or whether you're receiving it as the full text on your terminal.
There's bound to be much more of it.
Mm, yes, yes. Well, I mean, I know it's occurring now, because I occasionally read the literature still just a bit.
Because I suppose that one of the next things is that places like InSpec, there won't in fact be a distinction between the secondary and the primary service. I mean, that to the extent that you can have access to the journal text online,
mm-hmm.
You know, that presumably at some point will be a seamless shift from indexing, abstracting, which is giving you a clue as to what you might want,
mm-hmm.
to the full text.
Yes.
And that's why it's such interesting that the relationship with places like the AIP,
mm-hmm.
In this sort of development then becomes very important, because
yes.
How do you have access to the text,
mm-hmm.
you know, of a rival organization?
That's right. Yes.
You know,
yes.
As opposed to a cooperating or a
yes.
you know, confederation of agencies or whatever it is.
Yes, I think this is the thing that has certainly happened over the last 10 years, that the more and more you have all sorts of different people with different roles, and may have more than one role.
Mm.
So you've got Elsevier providing a large number of printed primary journal, also producing an abstract journal, also being in a position to produce abstract journal, an abstract journal of just their material,
mm.
or the abstracts of them, or the printed condition. And all these things can be available to, in a sense, on the internet or wherever else. And then you've got the people doing CD-ROM. And I'm just interested to see that they still all seem to be, if not thriving, at least they're still existing.
Yes.
The same names are coming up.
Yes.
I'm sorry, CD-ROM going.
Yes, it seems to have been completely changed.
Yes, yes. Well, yes, changed in once upon a time we knew exactly where we were. Now there's so many different ways you can go. Yes.
And I imagine that in the next few years there'll be quite a shake-up as to what is out there.
Could well be.
And that's what makes it interesting to look at. I mean, one of the things that InSpec had going for it, and you mentioned it, was that it had a very long history. I mean, that science abstracts and changes to InSpec and so on, and that gave you a sort of a weight and substance that helped when it came to dealing with competitors.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, because it, yes, the other thing that just before I ceased as director, was that we decided that we really had to clear up or make our tapes, our database in general, better. And because one of the troubles was that when you did an online search, you could list and you could see all the different errors. If we'd made a simple a spelling error in a person's name, anything else, that would come up when you were making an alphabetical list.
Mm.
And in other words, it was pinpointing all the errors. And we realised that particularly in the first year or two, it had we hadn't been as good in our quality as we eventually became. The other thing, of course, was that the classification had evolved over time, so it was more difficult to go back and search over the whole database with the 200 different things. So it was decided about 18 months before I left, that we really ought to seize this and do something about it. And we then started to do it. And I don't think any of us really realised just the sheer scale of it, because by this time we had 3.25 million documents, and our computers were working full time on doing the normal database, because it goes up and up every year.
Mm.
And when I left, I think it was about 214,000 documents a year, and I think it's now 300 something. Mm. And so we had very little space to do anything else, but we had obviously what we had to do was to look at each of these documents in turn and decide whether they were all right or not.
Mm-hmm.
Or documents, abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we could set up systems to do it, and where it would be done automatically, straightforward connections. Then there'd be other ones that had a fairly complicated algorithm before they got it right. There would be the other ones where simply it had to print out and say, what do I do about this?
Mm.
And but all of this required time, computing time, to do it. And we had to find out, we couldn't afford to install another duplicate set of computers to do this.
Mm.
So it was a matter of fitting in our schedule. And so we found that in the course of, we were normally working overnight, but there'd be some time between say 3 and 5 or 3 and 7 when you'd finished and you hadn't started the new day, and that was the time that they would fit in some of this revision work.
Mm.
And then of course you had weekends when you could get going, except unless it was one of the weekends when you normally did your updating of monthly indexes or something similar. And the great time that everybody rubbed their hands for was Christmas. And I can remember the first Christmas that we were doing this. I told people we got things set up, it was going to be automatic, and to forget about it. Right. And we had an operator in just checking things were keeping going, but that's all. And not to do anything further. And so after the holiday, I went in and had a look on the log for Christmas Day, and sure enough, 4 people had come in. It was all right. And they were fabulous. I mean, there was 2 of them particularly. I mean, a lot of the staff were involved, but 2 of them were distributing the stuff and making sure it was right. And they used to have enormous piles of printouts in their office waiting to be dealt with. And it was fantastic to me. If you hold on, definitely.
To achieve that revision.
Yes.
But then, retrospectively, you were applying the new classification retrospectively to the whole database, mm-hmm. in effect, and the thesaurus and
yes.
all that kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. It was a fantastic thing. It was one of these things that you couldn't impose on people. They had to be seizing the problem and taking it as their own and working out what to do with it. I mean, they had built up an enormous head of steam. They wanted to do it. I can remember going to my board and saying that we want to do this, and they said it would be very costly, and I said yes, but I remember they awarded me a small amount of money, some 100,000 or something similar, to start the work.
I'm not sure whether they thought that was going to be the amount that it was going to cost, but it was, I looked upon it as the amount to set the thing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we ever actually had a board minute that said you will spend the enormous sum of money that was eventually involved.
Mm-hmm. Did you find some problems? I just think that the applying retrospectively something developed recently to something that was indexed a long time ago, there'd be some problems with matching, wouldn't there? There'd be terms and concepts used in an earlier time that would be very difficult to translate into
the
field moves on and moves away from.
Yes, we were left with a residue of things that had to be looked at again from scratch, as it were. But, I mean, the idea and the way, the success of it, was to make sure that there were as few of them as possible. But, of course, as soon as you say that, as few of them as possible, there's going to be a lot of them in 3 and a quarter million.
See. Even if it's a small percentage, it produces a lot of records.
It's the same thing, you see, that I found to my cost when we're doing the SDI one with 800 profiles. If I thought now it would be interesting to find out how many of the 800 profiles had a particular thing in them. The first time that I thought of this, and I said to the girl who filed them, have a look at this. It was only to my embarrassment hours later that I realised that if you're doing anything 800 times, if it only takes a minute, it's still a very long time.
Yes, right.
Yes. So, that's...
Cyril
Cleverton. So, of the people that I had contact with, Cyril Cleverton was the one, I think, that influenced me most. And I admired most in a lot of different ways. And I'm not sure he ever got enough credit, but he got a fair bit of credit. I think he got perhaps more credit in America than he did in Britain, because he had a number of people who were unhappy with him.
I get none.
Bye. All right. You got, shall we have lunch?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Come back.